This morning we will welcome back to our program a guest who's been here before. We figured out that it was August the last time he was here, so we invited him back. Brian Johnson is his name. He's professor of journalism at the University of Illinois, and he teaches photojournalism. He is a former newspaper photographer. And so when he's here on the program, we talk about taking pictures. And we can take a wide range of questions. Of course, if you have questions about the hardware, things like camera bodies and film and lenses and flash and all that kind of stuff, you can call in with those questions. Or the other side of it is just what you can do to take better pictures with whatever kind of camera you have. So whether you're a very serious hobbyist, perhaps, or whether you're just a person who, you know, you take pictures when you go on vacation, you take pictures on family occasions, and you just want to get the best pictures that you can, and looking for some hints, well, I think we can try to help you with that. So any and all of that's great. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. And questions are welcome. Well, thanks for coming back.
Sure. Glad to be here.
I'm a little surprised it's been that long, but we looked and said, yeah.
Well, you know, you don't want to go over your Brian Johnson quota, so.
Well, we don't want to get the audience burned out on you. So they say, Brian Johnson, is he
You know, like 4 months, that would be too close. So 6 months, that's good.
Okay. Well, one of my colleagues heard that we were going to do the show on photography, and just as a way of passing on some information, thought that folks who are listening might be interested to know that there is an exhibit of photography by Ansel Adams going on in Indianapolis. And this is in a museum, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation of the name of this museum, so I pronounce it wrong. I hope people will forgive me. I guess I would say it was the Idlejorg Museum of American Indians and Western Art. It's in Indianapolis, and this exhibit opened last Saturday, and it will be there through March 25th. And they do have a website, eiteljorg.org. So that's the name of the place. And you can also call them 317-636-9378. So I imagine if you had the opportunity to see a large size,
yes,
the real things, good prints of his work, it probably just knock you right over.
And it absolutely does. You know, if you haven't seen any of Ansel Adams' work in person, you have never seen it, because, you know, look through the books, look at posters, it doesn't make any difference, because when you see the prints, you're amazed at how much detail there is. And I'm not saying that just because it's Ansel Adams, but it's just the truth. I mean, it's pretty incredible to see the work close up.
Yeah. I guess one of the – among the things that made him great was being a great technician and
right,
really understanding,
yes,
how this process – how to get the absolute most out of the process,
right,
that you can.
And he sometimes would spend days working on one print to get it the way he wanted it. So he was that dedicated to it. So I think it would be well worth their while to go see his work.
Well, a little later in the program, we'll talk about how you, too, can take pictures like Ansel Adams. At the moment here, we've got a couple callers. So we'll start out in Urbana with line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a hardware question.
Okay.
Here. I use a single lens reflex Minolta X700 camera.
Uh-huh.
It has developed a very strange glitch. It will only take pictures indoors.
Okay.
That is to say, I can't. I get everything set, press the shutter, and nothing happens.
Hmm.
Now, I have. Sometimes it doesn't happen indoors either, but I did succeed in finishing the roll I was trying to finish from taking the pictures from indoors.
Right.
And while initially when it started doing this, I assumed it was a battery problem.
Okay.
Took it in, replaced the battery. They claimed the old one tested out just fine, but I replaced it just in case. But it's still basically the same problem.
Okay, what kind of film were you shooting? What speed film was it?
Well, mostly Fuji 200 slide.
Okay. And I don't know with that camera, do you have to do anything with the lens to get it to, were you using it on auto exposure, like on a program mode?
I was doing it the semi-automatic, but I don't think it seemed to. I think I tried it more than one way,
okay.
If I set the aperture, it sets the film speed and so.
Okay, and was it able? With some cameras, it won't let you shoot if it's not setting a correct exposure. So,
no, this one. Well, okay, this one will do that if
you have a flash, maybe.
If you have it on program, but if you turn it to standard, it isn't a problem. If you turn it,
sure.
I can change between totally programmed and semi-automatic, which is what I usually use it on,
right.
And completely manual.
Right.
And
so it just doesn't let you shoot pictures at all.
It just won't let me shoot pictures outdoors, which was very frustrating when you had that snow drifts and then incredible shadows and all that kind of good thing.
You didn't have anyone put a curse on you or anything. it is odd. The first things that come to my mind were things you checked on. The battery would be the first culprit. The second thing would be that, if it was out of range, if it was, going to way overexpose, it wouldn't let you shoot. That could be something. But those are pretty much the normal things. I mean, I suppose the other thing that it could be on the slightest outside end of the scale would be maybe for outside and there was a little bit of moisture inside the camera that was condensing, and then that would be blocking the electronic contacts on the shutter release. Something like that could happen, but I wouldn't think it would be a, easily repeatable or a constant problem. So I can't really think of any reason outside unless, the exposure was way off and it was a camera that wouldn't take the picture if it couldn't get a good exposure. And is it autofocusing all right and everything?
No, it's a manual focus.
Oh, it's manual focus, so we don't have that problem.
I've never trusted an autofocus camera to know what I wanted to focus.
Right. Yeah, they're doing some neat things with autofocus that kind of help on that, but I think you're right. In general, it's definitely best to count on yourself to do the focusing. I can't think of a solution other than the things you've looked at. I guess take it to a camera shop and see what they think. The biggest problem is that anymore you don't find many local camera repair facilities.
There ain't no such animal. They have to send it in,
right.
And it'll be gone for 6 weeks.
Yes.
And I want to use it in the
yes. Yes, exactly right. So, so I can't think of any other solution other than the things you've checked. So I'm not going to be much more help than that.
Okay. Well, I thought you might have some.
Okay.
Suggestion.
And I'll keep thinking about it. If I think of something, we'll announce
okay.
it.
All right. Well, thanks
for
the call.
By the way, at some point, will you repeat the information on that Ansel Adams exhibit?
Sure.
That we were talking about earlier?
Sure.
I didn't get things written down properly.
I will do that. Sure thing.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to somebody here on a car phone, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a question here, two questions, actually. Is there a camera that would give me some of the latitude of taking real good photographs and at the same time might be digital, or would someone still be better off going with a single lens reflex camera so that you could have, all different types of, situations?
Sure. Well, the real question is how much money do you have to spend? Because there are some amazingly good digital cameras out there that are single lens reflex that aren't astronomically priced, meaning that just a few years ago we were talking $10,000, $12,000 for a camera like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are a variety of cameras probably starting in the $2,000 range on up to maybe $6,000. Olympus has a single lens reflex digital camera that's right in that $2,000 range. The difficulty with that camera is it doesn't have interchangeable lenses.
Sure.
It has lens attachments you can make that are somewhat cumbersome and seemingly like an afterthought. Canon has the D30, which is about $3,000. And, it's just like a normal 35mm single lens reflex, but it's digital. It has a 3.34 megapixel imaging chip, which is plenty plenty good.
One other thing. I've had two single-lens reflex cameras with interchangeable lenses, both Canon.
Right.
But after a number of years, I had to send them back at least two times for repair. It seemed like the shutter would hang up, or you'd press it down, and then it would just stay down. And they claimed it was the linkage. They cleaned it, came back, lasted for about 6 weeks or so, and then it would do the same thing.
Sure.
So I don't know. I mean, at what point do you really say, hey, listen, is that something with the single lens reflex that there would be, they're going to break down?
Right. Well, you know, there's definitely more moving parts in it, so it is that way. I mean, I have a whole shelf full of broken cameras from student use, and probably two-thirds of them had, you know, shutters that had jammed. So the shutters are very fragile, and they take a beating. And especially, I don't know how you use your cameras, but a lot of people, they don't use the camera maybe as regularly as the camera itself might like to keep them working.
Sure. Okay,
so,
thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Other questions are welcome. We're talking this morning about cameras and photography with Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. He teaches photojournalism. So if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. It seems that cameras are getting more and more. In a way, we have a lot of very simple point-and-shoot cameras.
Right.
But on the other hand, cameras seem to be getting more and more complicated. Just this fairly recently, my dad got a new one. And
right.
The instruction manual, it's like a phone book.
It is. I know. It's
and
true.
And you sort of feel like saying, okay, to the camera, just go out and take some pictures and come back.
Right.
You're done, because
right.
It's almost smart enough to go and do it by itself.
No, it's true. And, you know, frankly, that's the one nice thing with the cameras that have been coming out lately is that there's a range of settings. So, for instance, on the Canon cameras, which I'm most familiar with, they have what I call, I think, I don't know, Canon doesn't officially call it this, but it's kind of like the dummy setting. It's the green rectangle setting where it'll do everything. And in fact, it restricts you from doing anything. You know, it's like you can only do what it lets you do. And I was just watching 2001 A Space Odyssey last night, and it made me think of HAL a little bit.
Open the pod bay
doors,
HAL. Yes,
right.
HAL.
You people are going to ruin this mission. So,
so I'm going to take over.
I'm just going to take the picture for you. Uh-huh. But then they also have, for instance, on the Canons, and many of the other manufacturers are pretty much the same way, they have sort of a semi-I'll-do-everything-for-you range, where they have little icons like, you know, a portrait icon or a landscape icon, whatever. And then on the top part, they have the more traditional, you know, program setting where it'll set the shutter speed and aperture. It has the, you know, shutter speed setting or the time value setting where it'll set the where you set the shutter speed and the camera sets the aperture. Then they have the aperture value setting where you're setting the aperture and the camera's going to set the shutter speed, and then fully manual. So, what I tell my students in the beginning class, which we just went over the cameras last week in lab and we're going to hand out cameras this week, is that, you know, if all the stuff I've talked about doesn't sink in right now, I don't care about that. That is perfectly fine, because all you need to do is put the camera on this program setting, point the camera what you want it to shoot, and then take your picture. And then you concentrate on the compositional elements and work more with the content issues and let the camera do the technical side of things. That's to get them comfortable with that. So then as they learn more and understand more, then they can start making some choices about the technology so that they then can further their compositional and content choices, because they know that they're controlling the technology, meaning the shutter speed, the aperture, the focus, to best convey that content. So all the way from just point and shoot and click it to, okay, now I understand why the shutter speed works and why I might want to use a different shutter speed. You know, stop the action with a high shutter speed, let the action blur with a slow shutter speed. Mm-hmm. So
let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. What film would you recommend for using to make copies of black and white, old black and white photographs?
Well, that's a good question. So do you want just prints made then from them?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing you could do, now, do you have the capability to process the black and white yourself?
No.
Okay. So this is what you want to do. You want to go and get some Kodak CN400. I think they probably have some slower speeds, too.
TN or?
C as in cat.
I have a copy stand, by the way.
Okay, that's good. So, and I don't have a Kodak. I normally bring my Kodak brochure. I didn't bring it this time. I know they have a 400 speed. I think they have a slower speed, but I won't vouch for that because I don't have the information. But the advantage of this film is that it is processed just in normal color chemistry.
There's now the Sharper Image Lab now does black and white.
Right. Right.
And, what I want to do is make copies of. I don't want to use the color processing because I want something that's going to be more archival than color processing.
Okay, and so what you need to find out then is, A, how much is it going to cost to have them do the black and white? And two, what are they printing on to see if it really is going to be more archival than some of the color materials?
I think it's the black and white paper, whatever that is. I've asked them once before, but
right.
I can't remember the details.
You know, something else, too. So you're obviously in the Champaign-Urbana area.
Mm-hmm.
Over at Film Processing Limited, they also have a type of black and white paper that goes through the color chemistry that, but it's just black and white paper. And they have two varieties of it. They have a sepia-toned and a regular black-and-white-toned paper. And I believe that it's, you know, one of the archive papers. You know, I think it's a Fuji paper, I think. But that's another option as well. The biggest problem with black-and-white, if you're having someone else doing it, is a lot of times they're not doing as much of it, so they have to do it by hand, so that puts the cost way up.
Yeah.
And if they're, you know, photos that you want to archive, then maybe the cost isn't as much of an issue. But then, you know, at Better Image, I'm not sure how they're doing the process. You know, maybe they're doing it in some sort of automated format, so it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. And as I say, at Film Processing Limited, they also have that black and white paper that they run through their equipment that will give you a good neutral color tone or black and white tone. Or if you want to use a sepia tone, it gives it a really nice sepia tone look.
I did one roll using, it was a film T, I sound real dumb here, T something rather, Kodak.
Uh-huh, yeah, there's a T-Max, like a 100 and a 400. Uh-huh.
I think it was T-Max 100.
Right.
I metered it off the gray background of the copy stand.
Right.
Used that setting, but the pictures were kind of gray, and
right, and that was probably most likely because of the printing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest problem when you're not able to do the black and white yourself, is that to do a quick job printing, a lot of the places use really low contrast because then they don't have to worry about the highlights being way too white and lacking detail, or the shadows being way too dark and lacking detail. Instead, they just come out kind of all gray. So that's the biggest disadvantage.
Well, they said that they weren't pleased with the way they'd turned out, and they suggested that I try either overexposing the next roll that I was taking
uh-huh.
pictures of, or getting a yellow filter for the close-up lens.
Some of it depends, too, that depending upon how close you got and what your lens was, sometimes there is some light fall off, and you have to compensate for being in close enough to your image by giving it a little bit overexposure. So overexposing in general is, especially if you're just having a photomechanical process where they're using an enlarger,
mm-hmm.
Overexposing any negative film is usually a good idea. Overexposing, I'm talking about maybe by half of a stop. Two-thirds of a stop, probably not as much as a full f-stop of overexposure. So if it was T-Max 100, you could set your ISO at maybe, 64, and that would give you your it would automatically give you a little bit of overexposure. So some of the T-Max films, too, can be a little bit flat-looking, a little bit gray-looking in the results. So so that doesn't totally surprise me.
So you think the CN films might be a bit better then?
Well, you know, I would say, I mean, if you're going to do a lot of, I don't know how many you're going to do, but you might want to do a side-by-side test and shoot, you know, one roll of the CN film and then another roll of, you know, like a T-Max.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100 or 400 and see how they compared. But, you know, usually if things came out flat, I mean, they, you know, you have pretty good ability with black and white to change the contrast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with a lot of photo finishers is that they don't do enough black and white to really spend much time with it. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, a place like Better Image or Film Processing Limited, you know, they're more of a custom lab. They're going to be a little bit more hands-on with it, and that's a good place to start.
Okay. Well, it seems that, to me that this is one of the ways to go with to make good reproductions for people of family photographs and
right.
share them around and to have things that you can put on the wall.
Sure, right, right. I mean, if you want to put them on the wall, you definitely want to go that route, you know, shooting them on film and then having them, you know, do a nice quality print. I mean, if it was something where you just wanted to distribute the photos, sometimes having a color copy done is a nice solution because the color copiers have a real continuous tone effect. And, you know, the toners on the paper is a pretty long-lived process also. So that's...
Yeah,
that's,
I've done that too. That's an inexpensive way to get several pages. Photos on one page,
right,
and to share them,
right,
especially if you're trying to figure out who in the world
who's
is
who, right, exactly.
But one of the problems I've discovered with those is that they're not waterproof, and that if you get a drop of water on the surface of the paper, like if you carry it out in the rain from the copy shop, you've got a big splotch on the paper.
There,
to think about because sometimes things, you know,
right,
floods if, or you know, roof leaks or
right. I mean, if they're using a color laser printer though, they are waterproof. If they're using an inkjet printer to print them out, then that's where you'll run into the problem, because most inkjet is not waterproof. But the laser printer is waterproof because it's sort of a polyester toner that's melted onto the paper.
Speaking of making copies of photos, there
uh-huh.
there is a genealogy newsletter from at Ancestry.com, and recently, like within the last couple of days, they had an article in their daily newsletter about how to index and label photograph files that you're putting on your computer or a CD.
Uh-huh.
Because it's very easy to have all these pictures on
right.
them and not be able to figure out a way to label them in a way.
Right, right.
You can't figure out who the people are. So you're just perpetuating the problem. So there was an interesting and detailed article about that.
Oh, that's a good tip.
So I suggest that people check that out.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We're already midway through this part of Focus 580, talking about cameras photography with Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at U of I. Every once in a while we do this show and people seem to be interested. So you've got questions about either about the hardware stuff, cameras, lenses, or about just how do you take better pictures? Maybe you have a particular, like the last caller, you had some sort of particular problem, something you're trying to do and it's not working for you, and you'd like to have a little bit of advice. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Well, I'm curious now, just based on what the last caller said, if say you were taking a picture of a black and white photograph,
yes,
and you were using black and white film to take the picture,
yes,
and you were using color film to take the picture,
right,
and then you sat them side by side,
right,
would they look different?
Well, the CN film that I was talking about is actually black and white film that is just made to be processed in the color chemistry. So it's like color film, but they've taken all the color out of it, so you just have the black and white film left. But getting more to what you're saying, you know, one real popular way to duplicate images is to photograph them onto color slide film. And because the photograph is black and white that you're starting with, the original, if you photograph it, even if it's on color slide film, it comes out black and white in the slide. The biggest problem with some of the you know, these chromogenic black and white films. You know, you take them to your local 1 hour place. It's almost impossible to get a neutral color balance because they're usually printing them on color paper then, where they're trying to filter them out to be neutral. But usually they'll be a little bit warm or a little bit cool in their color cast. And that's what I thought was pretty neat about Film Processing Limited. They had this film. I think it's Fuji Crystal Archive. I think it's Fuji that's the manufacturer. But Fuji's products have been very stable archivally. I mean, you know, any product's going to eventually fade some, and I don't, you know if we're talking, you know, 100 years with that product. But what's neat about it is it's a black and white paper so that mm-hmm. you don't have the color cast. You get a nice neutral tonality. And then they also have the sepia tone paper that had a real rich sepia tone look to it. So if you wanted that look, you know, that would work. But the problem is with black and white is that not that many people are doing it. And if you take it to a lot of places, they send it away, and then you get your prints back and they look like mud. They're just so flat because black and white film, depending upon the shooting conditions, can exhibit a wide range of tonality, which means that you need to be somewhat careful when you're printing it. And most of the places that keep it cost effective aren't very careful when they print it, so they just put the contrast on incredibly low so that the whites, instead of being nice bright white with detail, they're kind of gray with detail, and the blacks are, instead of being rich black with detail, they're just kind of muddy, dark gray with detail. So it's really unsatisfying. It's probably the greatest tragedy of the march of time in photography is that getting good quality black and white work done, unless you're doing it yourself, and unless you want to spend a lot of money having someone else do it, is difficult. Mm-hmm. So,
well, at the beginning of the show, I did mention this Ansel Adams deal, and because the first caller said, "Would you mention again?" I will just do that. For people who are interested, there is an Ansel Adams exhibit that opened last Saturday in Indianapolis. And again, I'm not sure about the pronunciation of the name of this place, so if I'm getting this wrong, you'll have to forgive me. The Eitel Jorg Museum of American Indians and Western Art. It's spelled EITELJORG. And it opened last Saturday. We'll be there through March 25th. They do have a website, www.eiteljorg.org, or you can call 317-636-9378. And Brian said, definitely, even if you've seen his pictures in books,
right,
and you can, you should see what the real pictures look like, because they're just
amazing.
They're just stunning.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So how do we get pictures that look like that? Is it possible?
You spend your lifetime honing your skills and then spend days agonizing in the darkroom.
I knew it would be hard work.
It is. I mean, most of it is just practice and really developing a sense of the products, the materials you're working with. Try to keep consistency in the darkroom. Keeping the chemistry at a uniform temperature, usually 68 degrees. Being very good about, letting your prints drip before you move them to the next tray, using tongs instead of your fingers to move the prints down the line. Unfortunately, photography is a hobby or an avocation that takes a lot of money. To buy photo paper, to practice your printing. I mean, I used to take probably 5 prints to get one that I was happy with. Mm-hmm. Some prints, maybe I'd be lucky and I'd get it with 2. But even a negative, I'd be looking at saying, you know what? I think this looks like a, nicely distributed range of tones in this negative. I'll probably be able to get it in, 1 print, maybe 2. Well, it just would never happen because then I'd say, well, I could, this white area here is just a little bit too white. I know there's detail there that I could bring out if I just, hit that area with a little bit of burning, this shadow area is just a little bit too dark. I need to hold some light back. I need to dodge that area out and try to retain some of that detail. And frankly, that's the huge advantage of scanning in your work to a computer or having a digital product to begin with. This is going to be oversimplified, and I'll probably get angry callers saying, but you can see what you're doing right there. Whereas when you're in the dark room, you have to have a mental picture of that image being projected down on the photo paper and remember where those spots are. And sometimes you're trying to burn an area and you'll just overlap an area where you didn't want to hit. Mm-hmm. And if you're working with, let's say, Adobe Photoshop, you can get in and refine areas that you could never dream of doing if you're working in the darkroom. The biggest problem with using an electronic darkroom is getting a good quality scan in the first place, or if you're shooting with digital, getting a good image to begin with. Because the biggest problem that I found with a digital technology is that if you have highlights that are a little bit overexposed, there's just no detail there. It's just pure white, and there's nothing you can do in the computer side of things to bring that detail back. Whereas if you had a negative and it was overexposed, that detail was there, but you just needed to spend a little bit more time giving a little bit more exposure to that area of your print. But let's say you scan in that same negative and that area is a little bit overexposed. Well, unless you've got a really expensive drum scanner that's, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, a lot of those areas are just not going to expose properly in the scan, and they're going to be just solid white. So you've lost some of that detail there. So it's a real trade-off. I mean, while you're working in the computer, you really can get in much smaller areas than what you could ever imagine to have worked with before. You have much more control over having multiple contrasts through an image. But you're going to lose something on the other side because your scan's not going to be probably as good as you'd really like it to be. So then on the photo side, it's balanced by, well, you can retain some of that detail if you're printing it in the darkroom on, from a negative to photo paper, but then your precision is not going to be as good as it might have been if you're working on the computer. So
Now, for people who just want to do snapshots, uh-huh. Nowadays, cameras are really inexpensive. You can get cameras that are disposable,
right?
And it's not that hard to not that expensive to get prints. And in fact, there are places you can take them and you can see them in an hour, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
I keep sort of wondering about, as we see more and more digitizing of the world,
uh-huh.
whether we're going to get to the point where for those kind of camera users, there's going to be a day when digital probably is going to take the place of film.
Yeah. Well, I think it is definitely going to happen because the advantages, well, there are several advantages. There are disadvantages too, but let's talk about the advantages first. So you shoot a picture with a digital camera. Most digital cameras have a little LCD screen on the backside. So the instant you shoot that picture, you can look and see, was this in focus? Was the camera strap hanging in front of the lens? Any number of problems. You can see right away how it turned out. Then let's say that you've shot, your 24 pictures, and then, they're going to blow out the birthday candles next. You're like, oh, darn, I don't have another flash card to put in my camera. Well, you can scroll back through and say, you know what, I've got two pictures of Aunt Edna here, and one of them, she had her eyes closed, so I'm going to delete that picture. And then there you go. You've got at least one picture to take that, picture of the candles being blown out. So that's the advantage. Those are, I think, some really major, easy, obvious advantages of the digital side. I think the problem of the digital side, though, is that so you have all these pictures on the flash card. Are you going to print them all out? Because for the most part, you've got to print them all out yourself, right? You're going to use an inkjet printer. Then there are some inkjet printers now where you don't even need a computer. You just plug the little flash card from your camera right into the printer and it prints out your pictures right there for you. But let's say you've printed out, let's say you print out half of them. Well, the other half you never print out. So they're essentially lost to history. And then you've got them all on your flash card. Okay. Well, you're going to download those to your hard drive. And then what happens when your hard drive gets full? What happens when your hard drive dies when you get a new computer? Then are you going to spend the hours needed to then re-archive all those images on your new computer. I mean, and that's kind of the problem. Mm. But then on the photo side, let's look at it this way. Well, how many people could right now go into their photo drawer at home or their photo box or their photo whatever, and how many people could locate the negatives that went with that day's shooting? How many people could locate all of the photos that they shot from that shooting? Because that's usually what happens. It's like, oh, I've got these negatives. Well, I don't need these. I've got the prints. You know, they go somewhere else and they're lost. So that's why I liked what the caller said, who was trying to archive some of her family photos, about the article about a way to number and keep track of all the photos, because you might scan in all these photos, or you might have all these photos from your digital camera, but then they're just a morass of image files with nothing naming them. I always try to encourage my beginning students, when they're doing their final project, name this image file with something that'll make sense if you're only looking at the list of names. Because so often they'll put final project number one, final project number two, and I'll say, well, tell me, what is final project number 10? What's that a picture of? Well, of course they don't know. You know, I wouldn't know. But that's why when I name a file, I say, you know, what it says, starting a vet, you know, vet giving shot to cat, you know, or, you know, assistant cleaning up, you know, after shot or whatever. You know, you just have to name it something that makes sense. Well, that's fine for a smaller project. But if you have this huge project where you're archiving things, that's where the library and information science people can come in handy, because really a lot of what's happening in the digital realm, people are realizing the importance of databases and archiving things. And I think that's going to be, honestly, the thing we're going to hate ourselves the most for, is that we didn't do a good job archiving and indexing and keeping a database of what we're doing, because the digital camera is going to record, you know, frame 00013, you know, and then on down the line from there.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left, and if you have questions about cameras and photography, our guest is Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois. He teaches the courses in photojournalism. He was a newspaper photographer before he became a journalism professor, and spent a lot of time with a camera in his hands, and knows a lot of things about film and cameras and lenses and technique. So, again, if you have some particular question, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL.
You know, David, something that's happening, too, that's kind of actually funny to watch is that, you know, if you look back at old cars, you know, at the turn of the century, when they're, you know, is it going to be steam-powered? Is it going to be, you know, gasoline-powered? Is it going to be, I don't know, rubber band-powered? You know, and you had all these funny, quirky cars that came out. Well, the same thing is happening now in the digital camera realm. You have all these kind of oddball cameras coming out. You know, there's some cameras that have a little inkjet printer built right into the camera, so you can take the digital picture and it spits out a print. There are some that will record the image right on a floppy disk for you. There's one that'll even record it right on a CD for you as soon as you shoot it. And it's interesting and kind of funny to watch, because, you know, all these manufacturers are scrambling to figure out, you know, what's going to be the standard camera. You know, we're coming off of a time when we've had pretty good stability in the, you know, camera design market. You know, we've had the single lens reflex cameras. We've had kind of the point and shoot cameras. And now with the digital, it's kind of like, well, what are these? You know, are they going to be the traditional single lens reflex? You know, are they, you know, what are they going to have? You know, will people want them to be able to print right off the bat? Well, they want them to be archived right away on, you know, on a CD, so they won't have these flashcards. You know, what should we do? And it's kind of funny to watch the manufacturers. You can just see the designers in their labs. Well, how about if we, you know, and then we'll also, you know, throw this on here. Several manufacturers have attachments you can put on your Palm Pilot or on your Handspring visor to turn it into a digital camera, or even on a Game Boy, the little, you know, handheld video game things. I mean, there are camera attachments you can put on those. there are video conferencing cell phones. Even on CNN the other day, from the earthquakes, they had someone on, and they said, you know, via video phone. And, you know, it was a pretty good image. It was a little bit jerky, but, you know, right now it's sort of a free-for-all to determine what is going to be the standard format for these devices as we go forward. Mm. And that's why when people say, well, I want to get a digital camera, really the first question they need to ask themselves, well, how am I going to use this digital camera? What am I going to use it for? Because that's going to determine how much resolution that they're going to need, what sort of response time that they might need also. Jack Brighton was in right at the start of the show. He was taking a few snapshots with a digital camera he had gotten for free for, you know, when he bought a computer. You know, and it was a fairly low resolution one, meaning now that means a 1 megapixel camera, even though just a year or two ago that was a high resolution camera. But for instance, one thing that he noticed there is after he took the picture, it took the camera several seconds to be prepared to take the next picture. And so as you move up in price, you not only get more resolution, but you get some advantages like that built in where you'll be able to maybe take a burst of, you know, 7 or 8 photos or maybe 20 pictures all in a row. Well, maybe that's important to you, but maybe that doesn't matter at all. Maybe for some reason you need to be able to take a picture and have a printout right off the bat. Maybe you're doing ID photos for new employees or something. So maybe the camera that had the built-in printer on it would be a handy thing. Maybe on the other hand, you're doing a whole series of archive photos. So having the CD recorder built into the camera would be handy because you're going to shoot 100 photos and each one is going to be automatically archived for you. So I think people really need to look at, you know, why do I want this digital camera? What am I going to do with it? Because the answer might be, well, I don't need a digital camera. I just need to get a traditional 35 millimeter, maybe a point and shoot, and that's going to really do the job better for the person than getting a digital camera.
Yeah. Well, it seems whenever we get into an area like this and we're talking about some new technology or some area where things are really changing, and we do it with other kinds of shows, we talk about other kinds of things. I think people are often face that same dilemma. If they want to buy something, either they're going to upgrade or they want to buy a new, something that they have not had before. They're saying, well, you know, okay, do I buy a VCR now? I mean, right. I'm going to go out and buy a computer. Do I buy it this week? Do I wait for next week? Do I work for 3 months? And I suppose this is kind of that same, maybe that same sort of thing.
It is. You just really need to analyze. And what you, if you deal with technology at all, you have to say to yourself, you know what? This is the device I need at this moment. You know, this is the best price I can find. I need it now, so I'm going to buy it now. And then you can bank on the fact that, you know, the next day, a week later, a month later, 2 months later, that there's going to be something, quote, better on the market. It's going to be faster or bigger. It's going to have more features. That's just a given, and you just have to count on that and not beat yourself over the head about that, because, you know, if you wait for the optimum device, you will never buy anything, because nothing ever reaches the end where it's like, okay, this is the perfect device. I mean, even if you look at a VCR, you can buy a VCR now for $59, let's say. Well, the first one I bought, and this is after I waited for the price to come down, was still almost $500. But even today, so, you know, the $59 VCR does a good job, but then you're still limited by the fact that it's on tape and the quality of, you know, VHS is what it is. So even at that, the technology is sort of at the end of its life cycle. The quality is what it is. So you say, well, do I need a DVD player or do I need a VCR? Well, do you want to record? You know, the DVD recorders are still pricey and, you know, working out the bugs. So, it's just a matter of saying, well, what do I need this device for? How am I going to use it? And then finding the manufacturer that makes one that's going to fit.
Well, we'll get down to the point where we have a minute or two. Is there anything in terms of tips for, you know, taking pictures, sort of random
sure.
stuff that just kind of comes to
right,
your mind
right.
and say,
Well, the number one thing is to pay attention. I mean, it sounds so obvious, right? But it's to really even ask yourself, why am I taking this picture? And then work the composition, work the content so that it accomplishes that purpose. So if it's the pictures of the candles being blown out, get in close and just shoot that. If you're trying to shoot the overall of all the people at the party, then plan to really work on getting a good picture of that content. Rather than just kind of going snap, snap, snap and not really thinking about it, you have to just say, well, what is it that I'm trying to shoot? Why am I trying to shoot that? And now that I know the answers to those questions, how can I compose this picture to be effective communicating that message?
Yeah, I suppose that one of the things that the difference is between what the camera sees and the picture you end up with, one of the ways that's different between that and what you see is there's all in our visual field, there's so much stuff, there's
right.
so much clutter, and most of it we screen out.
We screen out. We have selective vision, and the camera doesn't do that. So that's why I say pay attention. Really look all the way around your viewfinder in the background, foreground. Make your eye get some exercise and then determine if you need to move to a different spot to crop out some things that aren't needed.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
For being here. Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Every once in a while, he stops by here. We talk about cameras and taking pictures, and I'm sure another day, maybe when we're getting close to the big vacation season and people are going to be wanting to go
out. That's right. Go out in the sand.
Do that. And
in the snow.
We'll do it again.
Okay, good.